It's a busy morning in business with results from AIB and Aer Lingus. With news of those, Emma McNamara joins us now from London, where she'll also be looking at the economy there. Morning, Emma.
Good morning, Rachel. And you mentioned Aer Lingus and AIB. There are also results from other companies like Smurfit Kappa and Tullow this morning. Well, AIB, as we've been hearing just since the stock exchange opened at about 7, has reported results this morning for the first 6 months of its financial year. Profit before tax was €437 million, and that's a €1.28 billion improvement on the same time last year. AIB says it's on track to meet its €350 million cost reduction target this year. During the first half of the year, it's sold assets and got a NAMA coupon for bonds, and that helped bring its figures up. On arrears management, the bank says the total number of accounts in arrears for owner-occupiers is down 9%, and at the end of June, it says 34,000 mortgage accounts were in arrears for more than 90 days. Its restructuring plan is currently being approved, or has just been approved, by the European Commission, and agreements have been reached on customers in difficulty and cost caps and a number of other things. And on outlook, while the bank says economic conditions have shown a steady improvement in the main markets it operates in, it still has challenges, though, in arrears and in reducing the size of its loan book. And over to Aer Lingus. I know that, Rachel, you'll be speaking to David Duffy of AIB just coming up to a quarter to eight this morning. Afterwards, I'll be speaking to the Aer Lingus chief executive, Christoph Müller. And the strike action that Aer Lingus had earlier this year didn't hit it much too badly. It managed to the best second quarter result in nearly 5 years. The airline said it delivered a strong performance for the first 6 months of 2014, and that was despite the adverse effect of operational disruptions and strong competition, particularly in some of its short-haul routes. Overall passenger volumes, it says, increased by 1% to 4.6 million, and the load factor was slightly higher, 0.6% higher, with capacity growth of 3.5%. And the first half of the year is seasonally usually loss-making for Aer Lingus, but the group's first half of 2014, the operating loss before net exceptional items of 9.9 million represents a 39.6% improvement over the previous year. I'll join you back at the Shoreditch Grind, that's a cafe where I am on sort of the Shoreditch, the Silicon Roundabout of London, at just about quarter to eight.
Thanks, Emma, and there's more from London later. And Deirdre Purcell is here with It Says in the Papers.
The Irish Times political editor Stephen Collins writes the lead story for his paper based on a tax policy initiative to be unveiled later today by Richard Bruton, Minister for Jobs. We're told that to encourage foreign direct investment in the years ahead, the strategy will aim to retain Ireland's 12.5% capital gains tax regime for foreign investors while closing off tax loopholes and supporting multilateral reform of the international tax system. The strategy, the plan for the strategy, if successful, should create a net 7,000 jobs per year between now and 2020. The agency photograph on the paper's front page was taken in the seconds after an Israeli missile strike on Gaza City yesterday, illustrating Mark Weiss's report from Jerusalem about intensive international efforts to end the fighting. The headline over his piece is "Gaza ceasefire in sight as 100 more die," although overnight events, as you've heard in the bulletin, seem to have put a damper on his optimism that a humanitarian truce is in prospect. Meanwhile, he writes, the director of Gaza's power plant said it would take months or a year to repair the facility after shells hit the main fuel tank, the fuel treatment facility, and two turbines. The Irish Independent and Irish Examiner both lead with a shock experienced by Michael O'Flynn, who, with his brother John, is one of the main shareholders and directors of the O'Flynn Construction Group, on learning that an interim examiner has been appointed to four of its key companies. The group, based in Ballincollig, County Cork, comprises 80 entities, and the examinership has been secured by the US private equity giant Blackstone, the world's biggest property firm. In May, Blackstone bought debts totalling €1.8 billion for €1 billion. The Times business section makes this story its lead, and in his statement to the media, Mr. O'Flynn said the move by Blackstone represents a very unexpected and aggressive move. He said that the loans, and some separate personal loans, are fully serviced and that all payments are fully up to date. All three papers also cover the story by an American judge who has rejected a request by the bankrupt property developer Sean Dunn to question under oath the chief executive of NAMA, Brendan McDonough. NAMA is trying to fight Mr. Dunn's discharge from bankruptcy because it would allow him to walk away from debts of $942 million, of which $343 million is owed to it. And every paper also covers yesterday's highly complex court case in Roscommon Circuit Court, which resulted in the jailing of a 41-year-old man who lives in Nenagh, County Tipperary, following his conviction for defrauding a vet of €250,000 in a land deal which never took place. In the course of the case, the man, who we're told has been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, admitted that while he had a wife and three children, he also had two fiancés here and a child with a fourth one in Poland. The Herald, Irish Daily Star and Irish Sun all lead with this. The Irish Daily Mail, meanwhile, leads with the cost of sending a child to school. All the papers take up the same story highlighted by Barnardo's, its survey having shown that Irish families are facing costs of more than €700 per child in some cases to cover bespoke uniforms, books and voluntary contributions, not to speak of what it costs additionally for school transport, school bags, trainers and extracurricular activities such as swimming and special events like school trips, and even contributions to stationery and photocopying costs. And finally for now, in her column for the Mail, Fiona Looney reveals that the sometimes controversial French film star Gérard Depardieu has been appointed Minister for Agriculture in Crimea, where he now lives, with a special brief, wait for it, to promote wine.
Thank you very much, Deirdre.
Gaza is waking up this morning counting its dead and injured after another night of rocket attacks from Israel. Gaza health officials say 43 people died overnight. And as Hamas continues to fire rockets into Israel, a Hamas commander has rejected suggestions that they're ready for a ceasefire. Mohammed Daif says his soldiers were eager for death. We'll be getting reaction from the United States later, but first let's go to Gaza, where we can talk to Mohammed Al-Sharif. He's a humanitarian aid worker with Global Communities. Mohammed Al-Sharif, good morning to you.
Good morning, sir.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what's been happening there overnight?
From where I live, the artillery shelling have not stopped. And most likely you may hear something during this small conversation. So far, 250,000 people have been displaced in desperate need of assistance and counting.
Is there electricity where you are? Is there any electricity in Gaza at the moment after the power plant being hit in the last day or two?
No, we have been living without electricity for the last 48 hours. So no electricity, and it doesn't seem like it's going to be on for a while. So most of us are trying to survive on whatever we have from UBSs and so on.
What other infrastructure has been hit?
So far, the electricity, the sewage treatment stations that has been hit, some of the communication lines have been hit. We're many things like the most importantly the electricity right now that is affecting everybody.
Where can help come from at this stage? There is some electricity, I gather, coming across the border from Israel, but for other supplies, for medicine, for water, can it get in and out of the strip at this stage?
Now, let me just correct that. We have 10 lines, electricity, power lines coming from Israel. So far, 8 out of 10 has been cut down or destroyed. With regards to medicine, yes, there are supplies coming in, but with the thousands of injured people, hardly hospitals, and the Ministry of Health is hardly surviving or managing the resources that they have.
Mohammed, for the 250,000 people, as you said, who have been displaced from their homes, and for those who are continuing to leave their homes because they're being told that rockets are on their way, where are they going? Because the UN shelters, we're being told, are pretty much full.
The majority of these 200,000 are currently staying at UN shelters, UN schools. Situation over there are extremely tragic. Other families currently seeking refuge in public buildings, public schools. And some of them are staying in private properties and trying to find a safe place to sit in.
This is not the first time, of course, that there has been an Israeli offensive on Gaza in recent years. How long are people expecting this to last?
This is a very difficult question to answer. Nobody have an expectation when this will last. People try to live day by day. Just survive every moment, try to stay safe. So this is our concerns. We cannot see where this is going to end or how it's going to end.
Mohammed Al-Sharif, a humanitarian aid worker with Global Communities, thank you very much for speaking to us from Gaza this morning. We'll have more on this story later.
The number of West Africans killed by the Ebola virus has risen to 672, according to the latest figures from the United Nations. This is now the largest recorded outbreak of Ebola, which kills up to 90% of those who contract it. In Sierra Leone, the doctor who led the fight against the virus has died. Sheikh Umar Khan has been hailed as a national hero. Tommy Trenchard is a journalist in Freetown, the capital of Sierra Leone, and he joins us on the line. Tommy, thank you for taking our call. Will you tell us, first of all, about this doctor who has died?
Yes, well, Dr. Khan was hailed, as you say, as a national hero. Sierra Leone doesn't have a lot of previous experience with Ebola, and Dr. Khan was one of the main virologists who was working at the main Kenema government hospital in the fight against this disease. He's been in a treatment center run by the medical charity Médecins Sans Frontières for the last week, but sadly we heard the news yesterday that he had succumbed to the disease that he was trying to fight.
How has the health system been coping with this outbreak of Ebola?
I think it's fair to say it's been overstretched. Sierra Leone's health system already had several significant problems in staffing, training, equipment. But the burden is being shared by MSF, which is currently running the largest treatment center over in the east of the country. The government hospital in Kenema has been having a few issues with safety of its staff members. They've lost now 11 to this disease since the first case was registered in late May.
How widespread is the virus in Sierra Leone? You mentioned there the east of the country. Is that the main problem area?
Yes, the east of the country has been very hard hit. It crossed the border from neighbouring Guinea into Kailahun district, and has been that's where we see the highest level of infection rates at the moment. That said, it does appear to be spreading. Last week, we had our first case in Freetown, and I'm told there have been two more since. Freetown is the capital of Sierra Leone, and is not a good environment for a contagious disease. It's very densely populated, a lot of slum areas, and with the rainy season setting in, general standards of hygiene are not ideal for this disease.
Even in Europe, public health authorities have been issuing statements about this outbreak, and I suppose that just goes to show how frightened people are of Ebola. What's been the public reaction in Sierra Leone?
Yeah, it had a very powerful psychological effect. In Sierra Leone, the reaction has been very mixed, and this has been one of the main problems that doctors have been having. A lot of people have reacted with denial, while, I mean, they say the disease doesn't exist at all, while others think that it's some kind of conspiracy by the government and the aid agencies to steal their limbs or sell the blood, and various other misinformation. And the problem is that this is keeping people from checking themselves into hospitals to get tested, which is aiding the spread of the disease and reducing chances of survival.
Another problem seems to be that it can take quite a while for the symptoms to present.
Yes, and this particularly is tricky when it comes to trying to restrict travel movements. I mean, the government has set up a series of checkpoints where motorists get their temperatures taken. But the reality is that with an incubation period of as much as 21 days, most of the people passing through these checkpoints with Ebola will go unnoticed. And the same, of course, applies for international travel. Last week we saw the first case in Nigeria, Africa's most populous country, which I think has sparked concern about how far this could spread.
Tommy Trenchard in Freetown, the Sierra Leonean capital. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on the line this morning.
You're listening to Morning Ireland. Let's go to sports news now. It's Galway's big week and our own Galway man is here in studio. Morning, Darren Farrell.
I am indeed. Very good morning to you as well, Gavin. It's day three of the Galway Festival. Today's feature, the Tote.com Galway Plate. Today's racing gets underway at 3 o'clock at Ballybrit. The big race goes to post at 5:30. Pádraig Lodge will be there for us and he's looking ahead to today's action.
7 millimetres of water have been applied to the track at Ballybrit overnight to ensure safe ground for day three of the festival. The Tote.com Galway Plate is the traditional Wednesday centrepiece. First run in 1869, a maximum field of 22 runners will take part in this year's renewal. Champion owner JP McManus has no fewer than 7 runners, with Tony McCoy travelling from England to ride the overnight favourite Alderwood. 3 of the runners are trained in Carlow by champion trainer Willie Mullins. Terminal, Away We Go and Ballinasloe.
Even though they haven't run since the spring, I think they're all in great form. You know, you need a lot of luck in the Galway Plate. It's a very tough, fast race. They're all handicappers. They all love this ground and the trip will suit them all. So I won't put you off any of them.
The big race has a prize fund of €200,000 and is due off at 5:30. Yesterday's meeting in Galway, which saw the Kevin Prendergast-trained Vastenay land the Topaz Mile, attracted an attendance of over 19,000. That's up over 900 on last year's figure.
Now, day two of Glorious Goodwood as well. Race fans anticipating a thrilling clash between Kingman and Tornado in the Sussex Stakes just after 3 o'clock this afternoon. Officials watered the track last night to ensure the ground is not too firm. Some concerns that John Gosden may withdraw Kingman if the ground is too quick. We'll have Don McLean along to preview all the action at 8:30 this morning here on the programme. The All-Ireland Football Quarterfinals get underway this weekend. The Kerry manager, Eamon Fitzmaurice, has named his starting 15 to face Galway on Sunday. Just one change from the team that beat Cork so comprehensively in that Munster football final. And it is Stephen O'Brien. He has a quad muscle injury and he's replaced by Michael Gainey in the half forward. A number of positional switches as well. The Bord Gáis Energy Munster under 21 hurling final between Clare and Cork takes place this evening. The Banner are bidding for a third provincial title in a row. Throw-in at Cusick Park in Ennis is at 7:15. I'm sure there's going to be a massive crowd down there for that. But Cork is their first appearance in the final since 2011. Alan Cadigan hopes his side can end their 7-year wait for provincial honours at this level.
The mood is very good, you know. I think it's been a long time since Cork have been an under-21 Munster title, you know. So winning the senior Munster title obviously stands to some of us, you know. So it'd be nice to do back-to-back. But again, like I said, we just take it one game at a time and one step at a time. And we're under no illusions how big of a task it will be to go up to Ennis with the crowd behind Clare. And, you know, so look, hopefully we'll come up with the win.
Well, the 2022 World Cup and Qatar back in the newspaper headlines this morning. Very interesting piece in the Irish Times and the Guardian. Do read it if you get a chance. It claims that more than 100 migrant workers building one of the stadiums in Doha earns as little as 55 cent an hour. The rate appears to breach the event organisers' own welfare rules. Qatar is spending 3 billion euro on building stadiums for the tournament. One of the workers' payslips, and this is really scary stuff, showed he'd earned 42 euro for working every day in April, including 38 hours of overtime. Scary stuff. In transfer news, Liverpool have confirmed the signing of the Belgium striker Divock Origi from Lille for close to 15 million euro. Just 19 years of age, he's agreed a 5-year deal. He will remain at the French club on loan next season. Celtic are away to Legia Warsaw in the first leg of their Champions League qualifier tonight. Anthony Stokes has travelled with the squad after recovering from a hamstring strain. The game gets underway at 7:45. Trent Johnson has decided to accept a coaching job with Cricket New South Wales. He'll begin a 2-year contract with the Australian side in September. The former Irish captain says it's a wonderful opportunity and one that he couldn't pass up. Finally, three Northern Irish boxers secured medals at the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow last night. Joe Fitzpatrick, Sean Duffy and Sean McClinchy all recorded wins in their quarterfinals. They're guaranteed bronze medals.
Thank you very much, Darren. The time.
On September the 18th, Scottish voters will go to the polls to decide whether or not they want an independent country. Whichever way the vote goes, it will be historic. A yes vote would see the formation of a new country and the end of the formal union, which has existed between Scotland and the United Kingdom since the 1700s. A no vote would bring an end to a debate which has been part of Scottish politics for generations. Over the course of the next 3 days, our reporter Fiona Mitchell will look at some of the issues surrounding the ballot.
So what we'll do, we're going to split the group into two so that we can cover more area, and we'll work off the two boards, okay? Malcolm, are you okay having the board for that group? Yep, perfect. Okay. So going out to speak to people today, we've got the names off the electoral register, and it's quite...
Katrina Headley of the Better Together campaign advises supporters who have gathered for what is now an ever more frequent door-to-door canvass. In just 8 weeks, voters will decide if they want independence for Scotland. Both sides know the next weeks are crucial.
Alex Salmond, Scottish National Party, 19,550.
Independence is a choice which has been on the cards ever since the Scottish National Party took an overall majority in the UK general election of 2011. An independence referendum was a core principle of the SNP manifesto. In July of that year, SNP leader Alex Salmond took his oath as First Minister of a devolved Scottish Parliament in front of Britain's Queen Elizabeth. Even then, he referenced the party's hope that one day Scotland might go it alone.
Your Majesty, can I quote from a recent speech which she made to another nation of these islands, and one which was received with great praise and warmth? At a banquet in Dublin Castle, after an impressive opening in the Irish language that I will not attempt to emulate, you said, "Together we have much to celebrate. The ties between our people, the shared values, the economic, business and cultural links that make us so much more than just neighbours. They make us firm friends. So there is much that we share, this much we know. But the nations of these islands are also distinctive, with our own unique history and culture, our own economic challenges and our own opportunities. Some of us believe the best way to articulate that uniqueness and tackle these challenges lies within ourselves."
The most pressing challenge to tackle now for the Yes side is making sure they win the referendum. Fiona Hislop is Scotland's Cabinet Secretary for Culture and External Affairs.
The main thing is the opportunity to grow our economy and to make sure that all of Scotland can share in that. And in terms of the fairness agenda, we're pursuing that we think that the social justice that we can be achieved is a prize that's very important to us. But we want to be a voice for a good, you know, for peace and prosperity in the world, and also as a good global citizen. So we want to be internationalists and cooperative as an independent nation.
But no campaigners like the Labour member of the Scottish Parliament, Malcolm Chisholm, says the common ground between Scotland and the UK is something which the Scottish people would be wrong to walk away from.
think I know what is fundamentally important for Scotland, because I don't think it's in the economic interests of Scotland to be an independent country. But also I think it's important for the UK, because I certainly feel solidarity with people in England, and I want to be part of their campaigns and their struggles. So I don't want to be separated off from the rest of the United Kingdom. But fundamentally, I think it's in Scotland's interest to stay part of the United Kingdom.
Along the main street of the Edinburgh area of Newington, opinion is mixed amongst business owners about how they intend to vote and what they feel independence might mean.
Well, we've tried everything else, so why not give it a chance? I think they'll be 10 million times better off. You'll just get rid of all the rubbish, start something new.
Even many Scottish people, they don't know. So what's the benefits for independence or like together? I'm just sitting on the fence. All politicians, they don't explain this is like good or this is bad.
I think there'll be a change. You know, we've got to kind of vote for independence first and then work on other issues in Scotland, you know, and then once we've got our independence, we can work on that, eh? And then the quicker we get that, the better it will be, you know, because then we can blame ourselves for our own mistakes.
While the gap between the two sides has occasionally narrowed in the polls, the No side has remained consistently ahead. But on the campaign trail, people like Malcolm Chisholm know there's no room for complacency.
I think the polls are fairly consistently showing that No is ahead, but nobody is complacent, because there's still, is it 8 or 9 weeks to go? And, you know, definitely things could happen, changes could take place. So we're all campaigning very hard. It's such an important vote. I think what I say to people is this is not a general election. This is forever. So it's very important.
That's Malcolm Chisholm, Labour MSP, ending that report. And tomorrow Fiona will look at the economic implications of the independence debate.
As you may have heard earlier on our business headlines, Allied Irish Banks has announced a profit of €437 million for the first half of this year. This compares to a loss of more than €750 million at the same time last year. And it's the first time the bank has reported a profit since 2008. You'll recall that at the height of the banking crisis, AIB was bailed out with €20 billion of government funds, meaning that all but a tiny part of the bank is now owned by the state. The bank's chief executive, David Duffy, is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Rachel.
Does this hasten the day, do you think, when the government starts to sell some of its stake in AIB?
Well, I think it's from our perspective, it's more about are we in a position that we are a stable, well-capitalized bank, and can we support the growth of the economy? I think as a byproduct of achieving those objectives, which we'd set out in our strategy, next year is how we look at it, is the year where if a stakeholder like the government wants to monetize its investment, it can do at any point from that stage onwards.
Now, the banks are facing European stress tests this year, and we're told that they will be stringent. How confident are you that AIB will pass its test?
I am confident about our overall capital position, and you know, you can never be entirely complacent about these things, but we have very strong capital levels on a pro forma basis. We have a Basel III ratio, which is what the Europeans worry about, of fully loaded 11.8%, which puts us in, you know, a very strong position relative to our peers. So I think that the way we're managing the bank, the evidence of the restructuring we've been able to undertake, and the 88% fall in our provisions, together with those levels of capital, would suggest that we are in a strong position to pass those tests comfortably.
A year ago, you told us that, I think at the time it was about 22-23% of mortgage loans were more than 90 days in arrears. What's the picture now?
Well, I think the overall, you know, situation in terms of arrears has improved significantly. I think we have seen a 6% reduction in average arrears, and we've seen a 9% reduction in the homeowner territory, which is of significant concern rather than buy-to-lets. So what we've seen is an inflection point, I think, in this cycle where we have the capability as a bank, we have products that the customers understand, and the engagement is very, very strong, and we're seeing great results from that engagement.
And when you talk about engagement, what do you mean? What sort of discussions are you having with people?
Well, we're very clear, you know, consistently from the beginning that where it's a home, we want to keep people in their home wherever possible. So when we engage with them, we want to have a conversation about all potential solutions that could possibly result in them being able to retain the home. And on businesses, very particularly, a lot of businesses are burdened by debt which was not related to the core business, and trying to restructure that up to and including write-offs where the debt is unsustainable. We're trying to engage in any solution possible that will leave that business viable and back functioning in the economy again.
And in terms of mortgages, how many repossessions have there been?
There have been about 80 repossessions, but the great majority of that's entirely voluntary.
How much mortgage lending then are you doing now?
Well, we have about 37% of the market, and if you look at it in drawdown terms, so by that I mean if somebody actually uses a mortgage, which is a more important statistic, we have over 35% of that market and a 17% increase in our approvals for the year. So I think we are the lead mortgage lender in the marketplace, and we are offering not only branches capabilities, online capabilities, but we have a fully online mortgage where you can actually execute your entire approval of a mortgage and receive the funds without having to visit a physical branch. So our objective is to make it easy for you to get a mortgage so long as it is a creditworthy application.
I know that in the recent past AIB raised with the government the possibility of lifting the €500,000 pay cap, and the question of bonuses was also raised. In the light of today's figures, will you be trying again?
I think to be very clear about what actually happened was it was not a request for bonuses or for lifting the cap. It was a request to understand what will happen in the system in the next few years as everybody returns to profitability and our competitive environment is much stronger. So that was the discussion really. And although we are profitable at this stage, we don't have any intention to go back and discuss any of those issues at all, because my focus and the team's focus here is deliver this full year of sustainable profitability and prove that we are adequately capitalized from the stress test. And at that point, it's at the discretion of the minister about sale, and any of those other matters can be discussed in those future years.
So you won't be looking for a pay rise?
No, as you may be aware, I mean, I've signed up for my own contract, which has been renewed recently, and I've done that on the original terms, including the 15% pay cut that I volunteered for. So that should be an explanation in that context.
David Duffy, Chief Executive of AIB, thank you very much for joining us. Emma McNamara is back. She's in London this morning, where today's topic is the startup economy around the Shoreditch area. But there's plenty more happening as well, Emma.
There is, and first I'm joined by Christoph Müller for Aer Lingus. He's the Chief Executive, who's stepping down next May. Mr. Müller, in these 6 months' results, there's a three-month period that's the best second quarter result for 5 years. How did that happen?
We have very strong trading, Emma. Good morning. Overall, very, very good results. We have been impacted by industrial action, but despite that fact, and we attribute 10 million just to that impact, it's most probably the strongest first half and second quarter we ever had in our history.
Operating loss was €9.9 million in the six-month period. That's a 39.6% increase on last year. You've mentioned the financial hit.
No, excuse me. Emma, I have to correct that. That is not an increase. It's a decrease in our losses. Or 40%.
That's what I meant. Excuse me. What effect have the strikes had on this? I know you mentioned the financial impact, but was there any evidence of damage to further bookings?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It is, number one, the impact on the day, simply not flying, not being able to transport the passenger who purchased the tickets, but more importantly, the loss of consumer confidence. That effect is two-thirds of the whole bill. And we were able, due to some very swift and decisive marketing actions, to recover part of it, but we are still carrying a backlog of negative bookings of approximately 10 million into the second half of the year. But despite that impact, our trading, particularly long haul, is strong enough to compensate.
Now, we had very strong results from Ryanair earlier this month, and it said, though, that during the week it was a difficult environment, so it warned and cautioned against optimism for the sector. Specifically to your airline, what do you think the future holds for the next 6 months?
We, I think, have developed a business model which will allow us, even in difficult market situations, to grow. We have deployed 25% additional long-haul capacity to North America This summer we sold 29%, so we are really outsold, so to speak. That is pointing in the right direction. I reckon, though, that the market conditions in continental Europe are getting more difficult. There is overcapacity, but we are managing also through our short-haul business very successfully.
You say you announced earlier this summer that you're leaving next May. Why are you leaving? What are you going to do?
Well, I think speaking as the longest serving CEO of Aer Lingus since the 80s, I believe it's the right time to hand over. The results are improving. We have the strongest balance sheet in the industry, and that is certainly a good point in time to look for succession.
And what about your chairmanship of OnePost?
That will, of course, be my task I will fulfill with highest dedication for the years to come.
Okay, Christoph Müller, Chief Executive of Aer Lingus, thanks very much for joining us this morning. And as you can most likely hear, I'm in a busy cafe and I'm joined by joined by people who are making startups and doing lots of business around the Shoreditch area in London. It's the Shoreditch Grind on London's Old Street roundabout, an area that's been emerging in recent years as London's technology and startup hub. Springing up because of these startups are interesting cafes and hangouts. This is one of them, and it doubles as a recording studio at night time. Now, yesterday, here at the Shoreditch Grind, I spoke to Anne Booty, Sophie Zurowski, and Charlotte George, who were having a meeting.
It's changed a lot. I moved away from London probably 10 years ago. I work here now, but I would say around this area, there's a lot of new businesses. It's very thriving. There's a lot going on. Yeah, it's just a lot going on, a real kind of hub of energy. And obviously, it's a real tech hub here now as well. My colleague Sophie and I work in Farringdon, so not far from here. And it's a tech and music company. So I'd say this kind of area and sort of 50 minutes walk that way, there's a lot of stuff going on, a big design hub as well.
All our music is online for our clients to access, for our clients to use. So technology is a huge, huge part of what we do. We wouldn't be able to have a business without it. So it's mostly for TV and radio, film. Corporate online, all sorts of content, video production.
Yes, I'm a film director. So much going on here, and quality of film and TV that gets made in Britain is, well, for me, much more exciting than the options there are in Australia. And although it's a bigger pond and you're a smaller fish and it's a lot harder to get into, once you do, there's the options, especially creatively, are much more fulfilling and interesting to me. I mean, Tech City is sort of interesting in the way that there's a lot of poverty in Hackney. And then there's this huge kind of new economic growth as well. And I'll be interested to see how they manage to sort of work that together and what Tech City can actually offer local people, because there should be opportunities there. And I feel like at the moment that's not really being exploited.
Janis Savisto is from Estonia, and he's worked in the nearby Look Mum No Hands Cafe, which is also a bike repair shop, for the last 3 years. He's the cafe's head barista.
Our owners, as a sort of business exercise, they try to identify as many different types of customers that we get, and the number was somewhere near 40.
And what would you say are the most common?
Well, definitely the quick morning regulars, flat white takeaway, latte takeaway. Most of our customers are people that work in the area. They're either people without offices who come to our place to work on their MacBooks, or they're just regular office workers that come for a quick lunch. Normally they spend about £12 in a lunch sitting.
There's talk of some cafes in London banning these people who just come in with their MacBook and sit for maybe 4 hours.
It's always a little bit difficult to gauge what you really need to do. Our aim is not to shove people out just because they want to sit and work, but we have to be quite vigilant and understand the moment when we need to start shifting those people away to make room for people that actually want to spend more.
So if I was to come in here and spend £12, how long would I be able to stay?
We never have stopwatches running. Most people don't tend to linger with the lunch. They just come in, have the salads, off they go. The sort of really regular customers that I see every morning, these guys are architects, designers, a couple of music producers from across the road. I'm guessing these guys are real estate agents.
Why do you think that?
They always look the same.
and keeping a different kind of professional eye on the clientele is Toby Miller. Toby is a regular, a professor of cultural studies, and he's taught at the film schools of New York University and at the University of California. He's written over 30 books, including one about the 60s TV show The Avengers.
I've just moved back to London after 20 years living in New York and Los Angeles. So I've been here on and off in London for the last year and a half, moving between here and LA. And quite obviously, this is an area where there's a lot of energy, particularly in the new media domain, the so-called Silicon Roundabout just down the street. Some of it stimulated, this energy, by government activity. Some of it stimulated by small entrepreneurs and so on. And there's a lot of hype associated with it as well. But one of the things I like in this little area, in the place where we are, Look Mum No Hands, is that there are people working. They're working in a vibrant way. I have no clue what they're working on, but I find that quite infectious. It's very similar in that in LA, they would be mostly writers hoping to peddle film scripts. You know, they're lonely, they're working alone at home, they want to go into a convivial collective environment, but one where there's ambient background, but nobody actually talking to them directly. Here, it's more likely, though, it's a guest to be graduate students at, say, City University, which is down the street, where I also used to work, young entrepreneurs or wannabe entrepreneurs associated with games companies or other high-tech innovations, or tourists, travelers, visitors who realize this is a place where they can feel welcome. And you're not hurried along. You're not told to finish and go. Though they don't like you using a laptop between 12 and 2 on the tables, I have to say.
They don't hurry you along if you're spending more than £12, I think.
Absolutely.
Toby Miller there saying that there's some hype, but that it is an infectiously creative area here. Well, with nearly 16,000 new companies started here around Silicon Roundabout, the Old Street Roundabout in Shoreditch in London, it's not really just hype. It's known as the flat white economy. It may have got a little bit of a hit overnight. The leading technology journal, TechCrunch, leads this morning with a story that London's Mayor Boris Johnson has missed an opportunity to spend £50 million of a fund set aside by the UK government to create a public building dedicated to both technology startups, events and public education around technology. And that will be on Old Street Roundabout itself, which I'm looking at now, which looks about a quarter built. Also surrounded by cranes, where about 8 skyscrapers are going to go up, which will house lots of creative space, residential units and commercial units in this city in months and years to come. Tomorrow we're going to be looking at the London property market. And for now, it's back to you guys in the studio.
Emma, thank you. Let's get a weather forecast now and say good morning to Deirdre Lowe at Met Éireann.
Good morning. It's a bright, fresh morning in many areas, but outbreaks of rain are affecting northern parts of Ulster, and this damp weather with patchy rain will sink down into Connacht and the rest of Ulster this morning. It'll stay mainly dry over the rest of the country with sunny spells, though increasing cloud will bring some drizzle later in the day to the west of Munster. Highest temperatures will range 18 to 22 degrees, warmest in the south and southeast in a moderate westerly breeze. It'll become dry in many areas this evening, but further rain will return to the north and northwest tonight. It's going to be a cloudy, misty night with lowest temperatures 13 to 15 degrees in a light westerly wind. So tomorrow, showery rain will become widespread in the west during the morning, and this will move east in the afternoon, giving some heavy or thundery downpours. But brighter, drier weather will follow from the northwest later, and highest temperatures tomorrow will again reach 18 to 22 degrees. Friday then is looking like a cool day. There'll be showers or longer spells of rain, giving some very heavy or thundery downpours locally, and highest temperatures just getting up to between 16 and 19 degrees at best, with light variable winds. And it is going to turn pretty cool on Friday night, with lowest temperatures of 8 to 10 degrees and some mist and fog patches. And northerly winds look like bringing in still rather cool and very showery weather for much of the bank holiday weekend. There will be some heavy rain or showers at times mixed in with sunny spells. It will turn a little milder though on bank holiday Monday as the winds switch direction to come from a southwesterly direction. Back to today then, some rain at times in the north and northwest, but mainly dry elsewhere with some nice sunny spells. Highest temperatures today 18 to 22 degrees. Good morning.